I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the turbulence in the arts community. The dispute at the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra has ended, and the musicians are back at work, but that episode demonstrates the changing dynamics in the world of the arts. At other arts organizations, we've seen management changes and other signs of transition. We will talk about all of this today with a great group of guests. Frank Basile, an arts supporter and funder, Lou Harry, the arts and entertainment editor with the Indianapolis Business Journal, Jessica DeSanto, the ISO, and Rick Graff, an ISO musician and union representative. Please join the discussion by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the turbulence in the arts community. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Fortunate to have as guests today for this first segment. We actually will be joined a little bit later by representatives from both sides of the dispute in the ISO, but we're joined in this first segment by Frank Basile, who is an arts supporter and funder. Frank, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, John. Thank you for inviting us.
It is good to have you here. And Lou Harry, who is the arts and entertainment editor with the Indianapolis Business Journal. Lou, welcome to the program.
A pleasure. Great to be here.
It is good to have you here. Well, I'm going to start first with sort of an overarching question on this. We've seen a fair bit of turmoil here, at least in the arts community here in central Indiana. Obviously, we had the labor dispute at ISO. We've seen a leadership change at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. I'm not even sure how I can describe in briefly the long-running soap opera in Carmel. Are these a series of coincidences, or is this a trend? Are they in some ways connected to a changing set of dynamics in the arts world? I'll start with you, Frank.
Well, I think, John, I'd answer that by saying it's both.
Okay, well, that's safe.
I think a lot relates to the economy and what has occurred, and organizations are reorganizing. They're having to change their model. They're having to become more efficient. They're having to become more creative in the way they set their programming, in the way they appeal to audiences. And I think all of this is good, and the organizations will be more streamlined and creative, I think, in the long run as a result of this. Now, on the other hand, they're just the natural things that happen. For example, someone gets a better job, like the CEO at the IMA, mm-hmm. and leaves, so mm-hmm. he's replaced. At the Center for the Performing Arts, mm-hmm. it's also hopefully a one-time occurrence where there was a sudden resignation about a year or so ago, and so that caused some turmoil in the short term. But mm-hmm. I think that's going to be settled in the long term, and it already is. It's in fact, the most recent occurrence that I think you alluded to earlier mm-hmm. Really has nothing to do with the center directly, but rather the political situation there in Carmel, which is not unlike the political situation throughout the country in Indianapolis as well. And the center just happens to be in the center of that.
Well, Lou Harry, I think we probably ought to bring people. Could you, since you've covered it extensively for the IBJ, could you talk a little bit about what went on with the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel?
Well, actually, just to clarify, I tend to cover the mm-hmm. the software of the arts more than the hardware. Mm-hmm. I write about the events. I write about the I review mm-hmm. extensively. I preview. I talk about what's created mm-hmm. more than what goes on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. However, short version, and correct me if I have mm-hmm. any of it. You know, Major Performing Arts Center opened in Carmel. Mm-hmm. Some people very much behind it. Some people very much against it. Some people in Indianapolis panicky about what will happen when a large performing arts center opens outside of Indianapolis itself. Does it pull audiences away, or does it build audiences? The first CEO hired ran into a little bit of trouble and ended up resigning. Period of more questions raised when Mr. Basile actually came in and took over to in the interim. New CEO there now. Is it CEO or new?
CEO.
CEO is the title. New CEO there now, and now it's a question mark. We'll see what happens. I mean, they've had their initial seasons now to see what audiences are responding to, what they're not. There's all kinds of funding questions still hovering up there, all, you know, tied to the mayor. And it's a lot of people very passionate about all sides of the issue. I think one of the things that was panicked about a little too much is the sense that, oh, by opening a performing arts center in Carmel, that's going to destroy the arts in Indianapolis. I think that devalues what we have in Indianapolis. It played provincially to me. I mean, when performing arts centers opened in Alexandria, Virginia, Washington, D.C. didn't go into a total panic and think there weren't going to be arts in Washington. I think that there are ways to incorporate all of it, and I'm seeing a lot of positive steps now with ways to link Carmel, the Performing Arts Center in Carmel, to what's going on in Indianapolis to make it more a part of the community. I didn't feel like the previous CEO was really terribly interested in making those connections.
And I might add on to what Lou was saying, if I can, since you mentioned that I was the interim CEO. It really has turned out, and this is anecdotal, there's no way to actually prove it, but that the percentage, the small percentage of people who attend performing arts events has actually increased as a result of the center being located in Carmel, involving now that huge market in the northern part of the, of this regional area, and that through collaboration, and I think that was the point that Lou was getting at, through collaboration between the organizations, it really has helped all. For example, organizations located in Indianapolis are performing at the Center for the Performing Arts and actually reaching an audience that they otherwise would not have had access to.
And we all know there are a lot of people who think that, you know, to go south of 86th Street is to go to Kentucky. You know? So it does bring another audience. It does create more options out there. But I think the, one of the biggest problems, we tend to look at the symptoms rather than what some of these underlying effects that create the challenges are. I think in talking about, yes, the labor dispute at the ISO or, you know, specifics of funding, those are very important topics, but we have to look at them in the context of what's going on in the arts and what's going on in Indianapolis.
Well, that's really where I want to go, and we are talking, obviously, about the turmoil and the turbulence, I guess, is a better term than turmoil in the arts community. Here on No Limits, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Or send us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. A lot of this, and I does seem to be question, concern about funding. Many of the anxieties that that you hear in relation to, I mean, I haven't heard any of you saying that, you know, that artists are not performing well or are not, you know, engaged with audiences in a way that they should be. It's figuring out what the funding formula is.
I'll challenge that a little bit. Some are and some aren't. The reality is 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I moved here about 15 years ago, and I saw a culture that said that you either had to say that everything is wonderful because otherwise you'd be betraying the local arts and hurting them, or you had to say that everything's terrible because how could it be any good if it's from Indianapolis? And I'm seeing more and more, and part of what my agenda has been at the IBJ is to get the conversation going for people to be comfortable saying that something wasn't very good. Because, you know, how do you know if anything's any good if everything's wonderful? Or at least that's how people are talking about it. So I think having a culture that is comfortable discussing the arts, good, bad, indifferent, works that connect and works that don't, that's when we get a healthier arts environment. Not by automatically saying, well, everything that's put on stage, everything that's put in galleries is absolutely wonderful. Therefore, we need to all get behind it.
But that is a somewhat different dynamic than, you know, for example, the kind of arguments we would hear about National Endowment for the Arts a generation ago, where they would almost say we need to support the arts regardless of the audience that they draw. To some degree, you're saying, Lou, is if I'm understanding your argument correctly, is that it's healthier and more vital in part because the audience is having an actual dialogue, conversation with the arts organizations. And that's a sign of vitality.
I think that
but
can
to some
be.
Degree, that's also tied to market forces, though. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're talking about the level of support and the level of engagement, that means you got to have people showing up.
Right.
Is that correct, Frank?
Yes, absolutely. And I'd like to second what Lou said, not because he's here, but he has actually been one of the forces in the city that has encouraged this type of positive dialogue about the arts, which has helped to increase the audience, as you mentioned, John, attending. And I think this is crucial because this is part of what the organizations need in order to sustain themselves, particularly in the economy that we've had in the last few years. And that's known as earned revenue, that from ticket sales. The other part of it is, and that was part of your original question, was contributed income. And that has suffered during the recession. And that's part of the reason why. That's one common denominator among the not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations is that the contributed income has gone down. So that's caused them to reorganize, to change their model, so to speak, as the ISO is doing, as Storytelling Arts did, as other organizations are doing. They're becoming more efficient with the resources that they have, and I think also becoming more creative in their offerings, in their appeal to the audience, in their marketing. I think they're doing more with less, and I think this in the long run will be positive as the economy improves. These improvements that were made because of the economy being down will sustain these organizations.
Now, and I want to stay on that point for just a second, Frank, and stay with you for just a moment. What accounts for the change, the fact that the level of contributed support has diminished to a degree? Is it all just the economy, or is there something generational or cultural going on that accounts for those changes? Or are you going to answer me again and say maybe all three?
Unfortunately, it is all. However, it is primarily related to the economy and the after effects of that, because even though the amount of money that people have to discretionary money that they can contribute to organizations has gone down, but even more than that, there's the uncertainty. You know, will I have a job? And maybe I should put away more money instead of contributing it. So I think, but a lot of it relates to the economy. However, I've seen as the economy has improved in the last few months and within the past year, I've noticed that fundraising has picked up in these organizations. I don't know if it's going to return to what it was before, but I tell you what the organizations are now gearing up to do, and that is pushing more planned giving, because whereas people are less likely to give from current income because of uncertainty, jobs, and so on and so forth, they're more likely to name an organization which fulfills their own passion that coincides with their values. They're more likely to put them in their will, for example. So planned giving is becoming a more important part of the contributed income.
And I presume also, having run a not-for-profit myself, a bigger part of the strategies of all of these organizations, too, because many of the people who do give at that level are approaching an age where estate planning becomes much more important, and you know there's not the evidence that the next generation or generations are going to give in quite the same patterns.
And that's the other part of your question related to the generational. So
part of it is Lou Harry, I will get you in here in just a second. Yeah, Lou Harry.
Oh, I was just going to chime in that one of the ongoing changes, though, is when you get more globalized companies, when you have fewer locally owned companies, when they get bought up by nationals, they're less likely to contribute to especially downtown arts organizations. If you don't have the CEO's family living in proximity to these arts organizations, you're less likely to see them sit on boards. You're less likely to see them contribute in a significant way. Not that every contribution is significant, but to see them at the levels that they used to be. When you had 10 locally owned downtown banks or however many there were, you're more likely to see those people involved civically in the arts community. That's something that's not going to come back.
So the nationalization, we've got, you know, basically some large economic forces here that are driving it. Real quickly, Lou Harry, I'll stay with you on this. How is this changing, you know, what people see in terms of arts organizations, the performance of the art that's put out there?
Well, the more that they're dependent on individual ticket sales, mm-hmm. the more likely the choices are going to be conservative. And I don't mean politically conservative, but I just mean things that
audience pleasers
have a really strong idea that an audience is going to like. It used to be that, for instance, a theater company would count on subscribers who would buy into 8 shows a year, 10 shows a year, whatever, because they trusted the organization. And even if they didn't like 2 or 3 of those shows, they trusted the organization was going to get in there. That allowed the company to take more chances. If you're relying on individual ticket sales and you're looking at the bottom line, it's like buying into a stock and having to look at every quarter rather than looking at long-term growth. You know, there's a dependence on that. And that leads to more conservative choices.
We are talking about the turmoil in the arts community. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the turbulence in the arts community today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We have been talking with Frank Basile, an arts supporter and funder, and Lou Harry, who is the arts and entertainment editor with the Indianapolis Business Journal. We're joined now by Jessica DeSanto, who is with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sorry, I had a bad case of tongue tie there. And Rick Graff, who is an ISO musician, plays the French horn, in fact, and a union representative. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
It's good to have you here. Well, first, we probably ought to talk about, since you guys are the news here, you're our news hook, as it were, and recently resolved the labor dispute. Would like to talk a little bit, and I'll start with Jessica DeSanto on this one, on what the issues were there, and then perhaps both of you can talk a little bit about how they got resolved.
Be happy to. You know, it's a rather complicated issue, and yet from the board and the management's perspective, we had to deal with something glaring, and that thing was the draw on the endowment. And coming into a new contract with our musicians, we had to realize that we had to get to a sustainable draw. This was the time. Our endowment is managed by the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra Foundation, a separate 501c3 for us. And that commitment has been very generous for the past decade of funding this great orchestra. And that was no longer going to be the case at those kinds of draws, which in a five-year period, it was around $50 million total. And we weren't able to, in essence, keep expenses in line with income. So we knew that we were facing that, and that was part of what brought the discussion when the bargaining started.
Well, and I'll to try to put this in perspective for listeners, how large is the corpus of the endowment?
It's been hovering at the best right before recession. It was around 125, and it has dipped now down to 80. That was as of August 31st. It's now about 82, so it hovers anywhere between 79 and 82 or so.
And what is the draw that the board wanted to get to the percentage level?
A sustainable draw is anywhere between 3 to 5%. And we needed to bring our draw down to that. And that's pretty substantial. So knowing that going in and creating a model that fits within that level of funding that matched up to contributed revenue, which was anywhere between 5.5 to 6.5 million each year, which was that's substantial in a market, especially during a recession. So we were very proud of our contributed revenue streams, but again, not enough to sustain at that current level.
And Rick Graff, I'm going to bring you in here a little bit. What was the impact on the musicians?
Well, the impact is very severe, of course. And, you know, I will say we have a differing view, obviously, of the way things work mm-hmm. here. We do recognize the financial issues that the society has gone through, and we recognize the troubles the endowment has gone through. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that our endowment board chose to do and the society chose to enact, which we still don't agree with, and I'm not saying in any way we're not happy to be back at work. First, let me say that. It's very good for us to be back, and we're really looking forward to our concerts this weekend, not to divert the conversation.
That's fine. No, go ahead.
But
we've learned from the first part of the segment here, that first part of the show, that audiences now are even more important than they were before.
Absolutely. So our audiences.
Feel free to plug.
And they can buy tickets this
weekend. Yeah, feel free to plug.
Our audiences have been so great to us during the lockout, and you know, we really hope they all come down and support us, you know, in the happy hour that we have today at 6:30 and the concerts we have Friday and Saturday evening also.
Where is that happy hour? If you want them to come, you got to tell them where
to go.
It's
all at the Circle Theater today. Okay. Today at 6:30, I think the doors open at 5 for the happy hour, and Friday night and Saturday. Friday is 8 o'clock. Saturday is 5:30 concert with our fabulous new maestro, Christoph Urbanski. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a great weekend of concerts. But to get back to the topic here, one of the issues that we saw, of course, is the large endowment draw that we took, particularly this last year. And we understand that, and you know, we had our own way to rectify the situation that we were in. When we look back at the past history of our endowment, we have to keep in mind that it's there to be sustained and to go forward, but it's really there for the purpose of providing art. That is our the music on that stage is our dividend, in essence. I mean, if you really we've had a difference of opinion because we really feel we're looking pretty much only at the financial side and the business side of things, and the musicians and the union feels that we're really looking not almost to the detriment of the artistic side. And our dividend has been incredible. I heard some of your discussions about artists and their success earlier. And I think that's been the case. I mean, with Christoph Urbanski and Jack Everly, you know, what goes on the stage, there's no question it's been a jewel for Indianapolis. And our big concern was that you have to balance that artistic side with the financial side. When we talk about our endowment, our draw rates have never been less than 7%. They've hovered most of the time in the last 20 years since I've been here in the 7 to 8%. We've always been told for 15, 17 straight years until the economy went down in 08 that those endowments should be 6%. The draw rates, excuse me, should be approximately 6%. It's great if they're lower. But if they're higher, it's successful as long as we continue to do endowment fundraising and continue to grow the endowment. And that's something that we haven't been able to do successfully in the last 10 or 12 years, and it's something that we, the musicians, feel really needs to happen in the future. We can't stagnate the endowment where it is and expect to live off of it. This 5% to 3% is a new thing, and I understand why it's there. It's come in because of the economy in the last 4 years, because when endowment funds could make 15 or 18%, who cares if you took 7 or 8 or 9%? You were putting a sizable amount back in. There is a new paradigm in that in terms of investing, and we understand that. The question is whether we as an orchestra really had to go off the cliff from a 7.5%, you know, average draw to all of a sudden 5 immediately, because that has serious artistic consequences.
Well, that's basically what you're talking about. If I understood what Jessica was saying, a $50 million draw over a 10-year period works out to about $5 million per year. If you're at $82 million, we're testing my math skills here, $82 million and you're talking about a maximum 5% draw on the endowment, you're automatically looking at about maximum of $4.1 million for the year, if I'm correct. Those of you who work with figures, I think is the case. And part of the concern, I'm going to go back to Frank Bastille for just a second on this, is some of the concern about this, since you're an arts funder and supporter, also that generational thing we were talking about in the first segment, where there is some uncertainty about whether the major donors who drive endowment giving are going to be out there a few years from now. Is that part of the concern with this, Frank Bastille?
Yes, that is part of the concern, because as both said, the endowment is being used at a perhaps unsustainable rate in the long run unless the endowment is replenished as we go along, and that's become increasingly difficult. But that's a challenge which needs to be faced. And as we mentioned earlier, planned giving in the long run is going to be a big part of that.
We are talking about the turbulence in the arts community here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Yes. I'm an art supporter, and I think we absolutely have world-class art museums, repertory theater, the symphony. My question is the Palladium in Carmel creating more, which is tax dollar supported, is it creating more supply than this metropolitan area has the current demand? You talked about earlier the loss of the headquarters, corporate headquarters here. There's only so many families of that higher income to go around, and many, if not most, live in Hamilton County. Have they taken their subscriptions and their major gifts to the Carmel Performing Arts Center versus downtown Indianapolis?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Margaret. Well, I'll throw that one to Jessica DeSanto. I mean, from the ISO's perspective, is there a worry that maybe the market here has gotten too saturated?
It's not something that I've tracked or researched, but this is all very early, of course. The Palladium is still very much in its infancy. You know, we've seen the use of that facility as a way to connect more to audiences instead of looking the other way. We brought two great performances in its inaugural year, classical music, to the Palladium, two sold-out houses. We presented Beethoven's Ninth, as well as a performance with Joshua Bell. Last year, we piloted several concerts in our pop series for Sundays up at the Palladium, and we've seen the growth in those audiences for those performances where, unfortunately, our downtown location on a Sunday was mm-hmm. starting to feel a little flat mm-hmm. In audience growth. There's a lot of things happening downtown, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of hurdles for people to jump over, we have found, with our Pops audiences for Sunday. So we're using that as an opportunity to see where the people are, what kinds of music they want, what kinds of presentations we can give. And we use a lot of facilities, in fact, in central Indiana. We go to Clues. We perform outside, of course, mm-hmm. in parks. We go to, of course, Connor Prairie. I mean, this is an art form that is able to be traveled, and thankfully so. So we can go to people instead of just waiting for them to come to us. And the Palladium is part of that mix.
If I can tie into
yes,
that,
please,
John,
Frank Basile.
You mentioned, Jessica had mentioned Joshua Bell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I happened to be at the Palladium when Joshua Bell performed with mm-hmm. With the Symphony Orchestra. And I was in the lobby with the then CEO, Simon Krukel. Mm. And Simon came up to me and he said, as we were watching the people enter, he said, "Do you recognize anybody here
mm-hmm.
from the Hilbert?" I said, "No." He said, "I don't either." And the next day, in his electronic newsletter called Simon Says, he said, "Last night at the Palladium, we received the names and contact information for 1,600 potential new donors and patrons."
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, that's anecdotal, but I think it gives you an idea that reinforces what Jessica said, that it really is making for a bigger pie for all of us to share.
Well, Margaret, though, I think has asked a pretty profound question here, and it's one that that also Lou Harry, I think, was speaking to and earlier in the show when talked about the ways that being more dependent upon the audience directly for support has affected some of the choices that arts organizations made. Rick Graff, I think, when you were talking, that was somewhat, this is a two-edged sword. I'm sure you love performing for audiences, but on the other hand, Lou suggested that it also means some of the choices you make are a little more conservative when you do that. How does this sit with the, you're the only one here on this panel who's an actual performer. How do you feel about that?
Well, we have to make sure we are catering the choices to the audiences to stay in business, as it were. And it's, you know, as a musician, those are the choices we often enjoy too. That doesn't mean we can't find avenues to do other things and to do things that may not bring in, you know, 1,800 people to the Circle Theater or, mm-hmm. you know, bring in the big donations. You know, everyone has a niche, and if we want to talk on the funding side, there you never know when you play that special concert whether it's new music or something unique. You never know, even if you only fill a quarter of the hall, if one of those people in the court of the hall, that's their love. Mm-hmm. And maybe they'll remove their support if you give it up. So it's hard to say you just have to go after the full audiences, because there are things I know that we've stopped doing and things we do because they're unique individuals either with strong funding potential or strong support, mm-hmm. and they love it. So you can't do that too much. It's a fine line to walk, I think.
We are talking about the turbulence in the arts community here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Chris, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Frank. This is Chris Douglas. How are you?
Fine, Chris. Yourself?
Okay. Well,
good to hear from
we've
you.
We've got friends here. So. Okay.
I was just going to comment that I think that when we talk about the potential change in cultural attitudes about giving, particularly with regard to replenishing endowments, I think part of that is potentially driven by tax incentives. And that in the 20th century, we were looking at an environment in which estates were taxed at levels that encouraged ultimately planning that produced charitable giving. And that the Symphony's endowment, for instance, probably was fueled by planning around the estate tax. And that as we go forward, to the degree that the estate tax is reduced or eliminated, that does have an impact potentially on charitable organizations being able to replenish coffers that formerly were filled, in part at least, by estate giving. So I just wanted to observe that these questions about funding for charitable organizations is not disconnected from the current debate about taxation.
Thanks very much for the call, Chris, and you've given us some food for thought. Well, and let's talk about that a little bit, because it has changed. To some degree, I think Lou Harry was saying he covered the software rather than the hardware of this, but it strikes me as this is a little bit similar to what happened with sports reporting a generation ago, where you suddenly had to start being aware of, contract terms and salary caps, mm-hmm. and all of that sort of stuff. Have the changing dynamics of the economics affected the way you have to do your job, Lou?
They affect, I think, the overall marketplace of ideas. They affect how people are talking about the arts and whether they're talking about the arts. I mean, often I will want to know, and I'm an arts consumer as much as I am an arts journalist, and I love going to see things. I like reading about it. I like finding out what's going on. I can't get to everything as much as I try. I like to see what other opinions are out there, and very often significant arts events can happen, and the ISO does concerts nearly every week, and that stuff should be covered, and I don't see much dialogue happening out there in media. So we're not talking about stuff. The other economic piece of this is the culture of free that's a growing thing among younger people. Mm-hmm. They're used to they pay for the delivery systems, mm-hmm. satellite cable and their smartphones, but they're not used to paying for the product as much. And so I worry about where
news
we are.
Organizations have learned a few lessons about that.
Right, and where that is. But I worry about where we are 20 years from now. Yeah. In a generation that's grown up in a culture of free, are they, when they are running their companies, are they going to see value in contributing to stuff that adds to the civic life?
Is it a difficult sell to, I'm going to give a shout out to the Indianapolis Business Journal. They devote a significant amount of space, energy, effort to covering the arts community. Has that been a tough call for them? Or
I think it is, and every year we have to look at, is it being supported? We are independent of advertising in the content selection, but if suddenly we were getting no advertising in my weekly e-blast, if we were not getting it on the arts pages, if we were not getting it online, there would be questions raised, I'm sure. So we always look at lots of ways to reach out to audiences in different ways, to get the message to the community that we are passionate about the arts. The fact that the arts are covered, not just by me, but also by an arts reporter, on a weekly basis in the paper and a daily basis in print, online, indicates that it's worth paying attention to. And I hope that message ripples out to the businesses, not just the individual readers that we reach, but also the businesses that care about what's in IBJ, that the arts are worth paying attention to here.
I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the turbulence in the arts community. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Frank Basile, who's an arts supporter and funder, Lou Harry, who is the arts and entertainment editor with the Indianapolis Business Journal, Jessica DeSanto, who is with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and Rick Graff, who is an ISO musician, plays the French horn, and union representative. They're here obviously talking about the fact that they've resolved a labor dispute and to some degree are starting to sing Kumbaya and encourage people to come back to the symphony. Well, we've gotten a tweet from a listener who says, I think, speaks to one of Rick's points, which is it's very succinct. It says, create first, money second, which is somewhat to you, was what you were trying to say, is that the arts, the quality of the performance to some degree has been left out of the discussion so far.
Well, yeah, it's one of the things that, you know, we feel, I think most musicians do, and I definitely know the musicians of the symphony feel very deeply, is that, and it all ties into funding. It's not we're not saying it, you know, that it's not our job. We don't have to worry about funding. We don't have to worry about the endowment. All we do is play great music and it all happens, because we know it's not that simple, unfortunately. But, you know, as was said by a former CEO of the Indianapolis Symphony to me in a negotiations, this was our first concessionary agreement when we were having troubles 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. He said, when I asked why was our development department budget going up, why was marketing going up, why were a lot of the budgets going up but the musicians going down? And he said, because we can't cut our way out of trouble. If we cut the whole organization, we lose funding. You know, mm-hmm. If we start cutting concerts, if we start cutting too much, it can become a spiral, and we have to be very sensitive to that. And you know, the more common thought that's out there, and there's a lot of people in the arts management world now who profess this, that you build a solid artistic engine, you build that power in quality and greatness, and if you have the organization around it that works well in development and marketing, you know, the money will come much easier. It won't come easy, trust me, I'm not that naive, but it will come easier than if the focus goes across away from artistic greatness. It's very hard to raise money for something that's not increasing and not building. And we have to make sure that in any arts organization, you don't lose that focus. You have to have greatness to be able to raise the money on it, and excellence. You have to build towards that. And if you start losing the excellence, I certainly wouldn't want to be in our development department if what happens on the stage is going downhill. And we're not saying that, I'm not saying that's happening in any sense, but we're doing everything we can to avoid that happening.
Well, and Frank Basile, I'm going to ask you this, because I think obviously your situation with the Center for the Performing Arts, where you had to come into a difficult situation and run that organization. When you have a storyline like this, where there's something that's actually happening off the stage that claims almost as much attention as the performance itself, if not more, how long does it take for the arts organization to move past that, and how does it move past that?
Well, I think it takes focus. It takes everybody within the organization to focus on achieving our goals, of whatever the mission is. As Rick said, presenting quality first-class entertainment. And that was our focus the whole time at the Center for the Performing Arts. We did not lose sight of the mission that we had of presenting world-class entertainment for Central Indiana residents. And we kept focused on that no matter what was happening on the outside, most of which did not really concern the center. For example, mm-hmm. you alluded earlier to the recent mm-hmm. press conference that took place. Mm-hmm. That was a situation strictly between the city of Carmel and the former CEO. It had nothing to do with the operation of the center. So our whole focus needs to stay on what we're presenting on the entertainment, the quality of the programming that we have at the center. And I think it's proven that it has maintained that focus and that high quality, and also integrating other Central Indiana organizations like the Symphony Orchestra, like Dance Kaleidoscope, like the American Pianist Association, and other organizations, including that in the programming for the Center for the Performing Arts. So the answer is that we have kept our eye on the ball of achieving our mission and did not get sidetracked into some of the peripheral issues that really did not concern us. I would like to make one quick comment the caller who called in earlier and mentioned about the estate tax, because we actually, of course, do not operate in a vacuum, just like the recession affected the way we operate and is changing the dynamics. The recession is making us, as we said earlier, to relook at the model that we're doing, just like the ISO is doing. The same thing with estate tax that the caller referred to, same way with the deductibility of charitable contributions and so on. So what happens in Washington, what happens in the Indiana State House, all of that affects the way the environment in which a performing arts organization or any arts organization operates.
Well, that's an important point, and I'm not sure the listeners quite got that, although the explanation was obviously very knowledgeable and thorough. But at least the way the tax code has been written, the government will underwrite a fair portion of particularly a significant gift and appreciated stock.
Yes.
And that has been some change. You're also given some tax advantages in terms of your estate planning for donating not just to arts organizations but to any 501c3, and that's in these tight times has come onto the block as well.
Yes.
Too. What I'd like to talk about now really is I know in the academic community, you know, there's a certain amount of pressure now for schools and institutions to start looking for ways to collaborate to link what the buzzwords are, our centers of excellence, so that we're not competing as directly. And I'm hearing to some degree that is a kind of model also that is emerging here in the arts community too, is that there are efforts in place to make sure that ISO and the Center for the Performing Arts, for example, dovetail their efforts and work to reinforce each other. Is that, Lou Harry, the future of the arts, at least here in Central Indiana?
I think it's part of it. There's good marriages and there's bad marriages. And I think it has to be the right artistic combination, not just fusing organizations together. There was talk a while ago about the symphony and the opera kind of fusing together. That, I think, wisely did not happen. But there are other ones that make sense, and sometimes they're surprising. I mean, the Indie Fringe Festival this year, which would seem to be the most downtown-y kind of event, had a program up at the Palladium before the Fringe Festival that went very well. Interesting collaboration. Dance Kaleidoscope has worked with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. The opera has worked with the Chamber Orchestra and with the symphony. I think there are strong possibilities of that. I think the collaboration between the Indianapolis Opera and IU Opera is an interesting... I wish the opera were able to do 5 original full productions every season, but in a climate where they can't, I think that's an innovative possible look, and I hope that we can find ways not just to collaborate with other professional arts organizations, but to also fuse them with some of the academic organizations. You know, IU and Purdue and Ball State are not that far away. There's talk now about a program between the Cabaret at the Columbia Club using college talent for a showcase. I think there's great ways to creatively explore collaboration, but not to be forced into collaboration.
And sometimes
sometimes
it's just the spirit of inspiration that can bring two organizations together. We had a couple of years ago Jim Beckel, who's our principal trombone, he's also a composer, and he was commissioned to write a piece for the performance at the ISO, and he used the IMA as a source of inspiration. He's always been very intrigued and enthusiastic about visual art, in particular his hometown museum. So he went over there. He worked closely with our former music director, Mario Vanzago, and he wrote the piece based on some of his favorite works. And we used that as a momentum for showing the richness of both art forms and how they can work together. It's not unlike many collaborations from a visual artist to a composer from years and years ago. So it was a really great moment for us.
Rick Graff, please.
Yeah, I think it's not only a good thing. I think it's imperative for the arts community to have these types of partnerships. But I think Lou makes a good point that it, they can't be forced upon one, or it's not one organization leading the other. It has to be an organic melding, and the best of those that I've been involved in have been just that, and great things. I mean, I think what the symphony's working on with the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel is fabulous, and I think, who knows what relationships we'll have in a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. I mean, that building, the question from the prior caller, I think is a fabulous thing to this community. Having a facility like that, in a location like that is beautiful. Not that we want to leave the Circle Theater, because we certainly don't, but opens doors, and the collaborations between, the opera, the Pianist Association, the International Violin Competition, you name it, across all of the spectrums of the arts and the art museum have been fabulous. Some of our greatest things have actually sprouted that way. They've gone elsewhere. I don't know how many remember back to the early Yuletide celebrations. Mm-hmm. Those were formed with, and I don't remember the companies back then, but those were formed with, the symphonic choir and I believe it was the dance company in town. I wasn't here then, but it didn't. Yeah, it was Butler, Butler Ballet. I mean, it was not the symphony. It was bringing together a bunch of arts organizations to do a great Christmas show. And it's become, an icon of what, across the country, it's been an icon of what a fabulous Christmas show can be for a community.
And when it's driven by a desire for artistic excellence, and not just, hey, let's expand our market.
Yeah,
let's,
share our
let's put people in the seats. Yeah.
Very good point, Lou.
We are talking about the turbulence in the arts community here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to stay with you for just a moment, Rick, because I think that in listening to you, I'm wondering if we're going to see, to tell kind of a backstory here. I've been a journalist almost all of my career, and when I was training and preparing to be a journalist, they kept us as far, for ethical reasons, as far away from the business side of running a newspaper or a news organization as possible. That's no longer a realistic model for training young journalists. They need to know this stuff in order, and they have to develop entrepreneurial skills. Do you worry to some degree that the same thing's going to happen with musicians or artists, that they're, in addition to performing their art, they're going to have to be little many MBAs?
Well, I think they do, and I think there are a few. I'm not tied in with a lot of the higher education institutions in this country, but I know there are several that now require and offer the business side of music as a requirement for getting a performance degree. When I was in college, that wasn't even thought of. I mean, the business of music was for people who were in the business side of music, not the art side. But I think that's changed drastically. The way we as musicians learn it is, is sort of by line of fire over the years. I was lucky as I grew up in the Chicago area, and my father's a flutist in the Chicago Symphony. So, I mean, I walked a picket line in 71 with him. I learned about labor disputes. I learned about contracts. I learned about the structure of board and management stuff long before I got to a professional orchestra myself. So I had a step up, but most musicians don't have that. They are sort of living in their world of practice room and music and the higher arts, and there is a learning curve, and it does affect things. And I think there will be a change, and I think most universities are seeing that.
Rick Sharp, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for including me.
Certainly. We're getting close on time, so if we get to your question or comment fairly quickly.
I'll be honest, I'm on the road, and I'm having a slight bit of difficulty. I tuned in late, and I'm sorry for that, because I do enjoy your program.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I heard mention of the press conference. So particular, I was calling in because I wanted to dovetail on Frank Basile's statement. The comments that I made this week actually had absolutely nothing to do with the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Frank did an extraordinary job as the interim CEO and president. He inherited a very strong organization in the first place, and that all was borne out, I believe, once the results of the internal review conducted wisely by the centers and the internal audit was done. And it showed that the operation of the centers was in fine shape. Frank built on that. I believe he did a completely smooth handoff to Tanya Kostrovit and Muskalenko, who has just hit the ground running. This was strictly a discussion within the Carmel City government, mm-hmm. about an issue that concerned the Carmel City government. I have no doubts about the strength of the centers now and moving forward.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Yeah, we appreciate your calling in on that. And I agree with everything that you said there, and I appreciate your clarifying that. Rick, incidentally, is president of the Carmel City Council. Correct.
Yes.
Thank you, Rick.
Yes. Thanks very much for the call.
Too many titles.
Okay.
and while we're talking about the Center for the Performing Arts, I'm going to get in a plug. Tonight
Please
we
do.
Have Natalie Cole appearing at the Palladium.
Unforgettable.
Okay, that's
thank you very much
for
the call.
She starts at 7:30, right?
That's correct.
So happy hour first, and then you go up to Carmel.
And then you can scoot north from there. But that raises, we've got just a short period of time. I'd like to go around some of this. We've talked about the performance quality, but it also strikes me in listening to this, leading an arts organization now is going to become an increasingly difficult proposition. Do you worry about that to some degree, Frank Basile, that we're going to have to find people who have, you know, superb fundraising skills, superb management skills, superb communication skills, have to be politically savvy?
This is correct. Otherwise, perhaps part of the answer will be to divide the job between a chief operating officer and a chief executive officer and have one being the internal in charge of internal operations and the other external operations, such as fundraising. But it is becoming an increasingly complex job as our entire environment, as we talked about earlier, becomes more complex and more difficult to deal with.
Is it harder to attract people to do it now, to do that kind of work, Frank Basile?
Well, you know, you might think so. However, when we did our search for a new CEO at the Center for the Performing Arts, we had a fairly high number of people who applied. Perhaps it was because of the fact that we do have this beautiful new facility in Carmel. But we didn't have any trouble attracting a CEO, and we ended up with an excellent one in Tanya.
Great. And Rick Graff, we've got about 10 seconds.
Absolutely. Well, one very quick comment, which is that I think when we have healthy economies like we have in the past, pretty much all the CEOs of arts organizations fare well and look good. When we deal with the troubled times we're in now, we see who is really top-notch talent, and I think it makes a big difference. This is the era now when it separates the girls from the ladies or men from the boys. I don't want to be sexist here, but
like Mitt Romney. Mind is full of women.
It really does. It really does separate who has the ability. So.
We have had a great show today, talking with Frank Basile, Lou Harry, Jessica DeSanto, and Rick Graff. Thank you all for joining me. It was a pleasure having you here.
Thank you, John.
We will be back next week when we're going to talk about what actually motivates voters to make their choices. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.